Welcome, friends, to another edition of Economic Update, weekly program devoted to the economic dimensions of our lives, jobs, incomes, debts, children's jobs, children's income, and all that. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life, and currently I teach at the New School University in New York City. Let's jump right in to this last week's events. There's so many of them, I hardly know where to start. The international markets were roiled this last week when the value of the Chinese currency was allowed to drop. This is a decision made at the highest levels of the Chinese government, the People's Republic of China, and it meant that over the week, 3%, 4%, 5% or so of the value of the Chinese currency dropped. As usual with events like this, there are many contributing factors. Which of them weighed how heavily in the minds of Chinese policymakers is anybody's guess. Newspapers and media who tell you they know why this happened are people you shouldn't listen to. Here are some of the reasons. China has been selling fewer goods abroad. That's because of the crisis in Western Europe and the United States, a crisis which, despite all the talk about recovery, is very much with us, and one of the signs is a decrease in the exports from the People's Republic of China. When fewer people buy Chinese exports, the need for the Chinese currency drops, of course, since you're not buying what you used to buy. And when that happens, demand for the Chinese currency drops, which means if you allow it to be shaped by market forces, which the Chinese at least partly do, that will depress the value. It's also possible that the Chinese government wants to depress the value of its currency. Why? For the same reason that other governments do that sort of thing. If your currency is cheaper in the world, it means other people can buy more of your money with their money than they used to be able to, and so everything in your country becomes cheaper since the cost of the currency used to buy what you produce becomes cheaper. And so countries in difficulty depress the value of their currency in order to get out of the difficulty. This, by the way, this manipulation of your currency is something done by all countries sooner or later, most of the time, more or less. The United States has done that, Britain has done it, France, Germany, Italy, Russia, you name it, they've done it. When you hear political leaders, like those in the United States over the last week, jumping up and saying this is somehow cheating, you're talking, or you're listening rather, to someone who's either ignorant, that's the kindest interpretation I could make, or simply assuming that it's worth a moment in the news to get your face out there saying something that's so silly that anyone who's ever studied economics is embarrassed. Where this will go, how far the Chinese will go in letting their currency drop or pushing it down, no one knows. Time will tell. What is true is that as the Chinese currency depreciates, becomes less valuable relative to other currencies, it will mean that American companies thinking of closing their operations in the United States and opening instead in China will now have an incentive, a bit more strong incentive than they had before, to do that. Next economic update. Americans are obviously interested in a way no one foresaw in the arguments of Bernie Sanders, who's running for the Democratic nomination. I do not endorse any candidate, including Mr. Sanders, but I am struck as an economic analyst by the fact that his positions, which are in favor of cutting austerity, more government spending, creating a jobs program, these kinds of things are not only being said openly by a candidate for president, and he's the only one doing that in a systematic way, as indeed he has been one of the few voices like that for decades. But what's even more important is he's getting an enormous positive response. Wherever he goes, huge crowds are turning out. Clearly, they like the message. This makes me also interested in bringing to everyone's attention the fact that in Great Britain, something very similar is happening. There, the name of the fellow is Jeremy Corbyn. Like Mr. Sanders, he's older. He's in his late 60s. Not quite as old as Bernie Sanders, but getting there. Been around a long time. Clearly has the credentials. He's in favor of their national health service and building it up, rather than, as the current government is doing, tearing it down. He is pushing everybody else to the left politically and economically. But unlike Mr. Sanders, Mr. Corbyn is shown by the polls about to win the leadership of the Labour Party in England, which is the number two party after the governing party, and that would change British politics. Conservatives of all kinds, on all sides of their political spectrum, are freaked out and mostly hostile to Mr. Corbyn, which is the truth here in the United States vis-a-vis Mr. Sanders. But in both countries, an anti-austerity, very progressive, socialist and explicitly socialist economic perspective is getting much more support than the pundits and the observers imagined. Next update. I want to give a shout out to Allegheny Community College in Pennsylvania. The adjunct instructors, and I'm going to explain what that is in a moment, the adjunct instructors there have worked for a long time under horrific conditions to finally get a union. They had an election, the union won, and these adjunct teachers, adjunct instructors, now have a union. So let's look at this situation. I've been a professor all my life. When I graduated and got my PhD and entered the profession of teaching, I anticipated, I was led to believe, and I indeed got what was then thought to be your normal, regular teaching position. The idea was I would teach two or three courses each semester. I would give myself to the process of teaching, which meant I would read everything there was, so that I really knew what I was talking about, so I could answer students' questions, so I could take time with my students to meet with them in what we call office hours, sometimes for an hour or two or three, going over material that I hadn't made sufficiently clear, going over material that the student found difficult, going over related material beyond what was in the course, because the student was excited and interested in learning about this. Two or three such courses, 20 to 30 to 40 students, that's a lot of people to be working with in an ongoing way, reading their papers, taking the time to really correct the papers so that the writing of a paper would be a learning experience. I got a reasonable salary. No one ever got rich by being a professor in the United States because you don't get paid anything like what that would require. And you're dealing with young people, developing in them the love of learning, the appreciation for what knowledge can do, and the capacity to communicate what they know and what they learn to other people for all the social benefits that come from that. Then about 35 years ago, a movement shook up higher education in the United States, and it mostly had to do with money. That's why I'm talking about it, with economics. Most people who go to colleges and universities, three-quarters of all the people who do that in the United States, go to a public school, a public university. Higher education is mostly a public activity in the United States. And across the country, wealthy people and corporations were determined to pay lower taxes. They mobilized the political support, the intellectual support, the media, what was necessary to reduce the taxes they pay. For a while, state governments, and that's who's responsible for public higher education in America, for a while, state governments responded by shifting the burden of taxes onto the mass of people, trying to hold on to the revenue so they could continue to provide public services. But eventually, the mass of people protested. They didn't want to pay more taxes. So they became part in an ironic, sad twist, part of the movement led by corporations and the rich to cut taxes. The end result was state budgets, state governments, didn't have the money they once had, and so they had to cut back. And one of the areas they cut back was in quote-unquote higher education. They cut the budgets of the state universities, the state colleges, the community colleges, all of that. And so these colleges were forced, having no money, basically, to make a long story short, to stop hiring professors like me, to stop hiring young people coming out of our graduate programs to be professors in terms of what that usually meant. Instead, here's what they did. They went to young people still working on their doctoral dissertations, still finishing their education, or they even went to people who had finished and gotten their degrees, and they said, we don't have the old positions anymore. We don't have that arrangement. You're going to have to be, here it comes now, an adjunct. What is an adjunct? You're not a regular professor. You're not even given an office most of the time. You're paid per course that you're teaching. And how much are you paid? Very little. Ranges in this country from $2,500 a course all the way up to $6,000 or $7,000 per course. But do the arithmetic. You can't teach two or three courses and survive on that amount of money. So what the adjunct was really being told is, if you want to teach college, you're going to have to teach five, six, seven courses, maybe two at this school, then you run across town or across the state or drive someplace and teach a couple others. We're not going to pay you anything like what we used to pay professors, and you're not going to have the time. That's what's happened for the last 30 years, so that now the bulk, the majority of education at colleges and universities in this country is done by adjuncts. These are people teaching five, six, or more courses per semester. They therefore cannot spend time reading. They can't spend time in office hours with students, providing the kind of attention that any real education needs. They can't be there for their students in the way that a mentor and a teacher is supposed to be. It's cheap education, and that's what it was designed to be. It shortchanges an entire generation of college students who are getting much less quality education, not because the teachers don't care, but because this is a system that thinks it's economizing and does not want to face the horrific damage it is doing to the quality of what our graduates know and what they can teach to others. It is a disaster building slowly. The only thing that makes it worse is that we have at the same time so badly cut the budgets of education that we require students to borrow more money than ever before to get this lower quality education than we have ever provided. Charging more, delivering less. Capitalist efficiency, you must be kidding. And it is, of course, understandable that the adjuncts, driven the way they are, overworked, underpaid, in a parody of higher education, would sooner or later form a union to try to do something, to be able to do what they want to do, which is be good professors, to be teachers, and get paid a living income that can allow them to do that. And they're confronting a system that is looking to save money at the expense of something that is really among the most important things any population can do for its young people. So I want to congratulate the adjunct professors at Allegheny Community College in Pennsylvania for forming a union and using that as a way to begin to change this catastrophic situation. Next item. Very exciting for me to talk about. War. Well, not military war. I'm talking about war among the soda pop companies. And above all, of course, the two giants, Pepsi-Cola, and Coca-Cola. Two items caught my attention about soda pop this last week. First, there was a decision by the Pepsi-Cola company to do something about the artificial sweetener in their drink Diet Pepsi. Aspartame, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, has been in the news for quite a while. And there is some evidence and a great deal of debate over whether aspartame is safe for human beings to use. Pepsi-Cola decided that it would no longer use aspartame as its artificial sweetener, and makes a big point of suggesting that human safety is part of the reason it's doing that. Coca-Cola has chosen not to replace aspartame, insisting that it's perfectly safe. Well, what is the public going to do in this situation? You're going to drink the one or the other? Are you going to play Russian roulette with your soda pop? Here's the peculiar reality. These two companies are going to go to war trying to convince us what is or isn't safe for us to drink. But wait a minute. These are not companies that are doctors. These are not companies that have spent lifetimes of studying this material with the credentials to give us advice. They should be forbidden from doing this. We know what they're doing. They're trying to make money to sell more of whatever it is they make. End of story. They shouldn't be in the medical advice business. So we don't know who to trust. We know we're being bombarded by people who have a completely different interest. And how are we then to make an informed medical decision? This is a capitalist economic mistake in the process, and we're the victims. Coke and Pepsi were in the news again. This is interesting. This time it was more Coke than Pepsi taking the initiative. See, it turns out we have an obesity epidemic in the United States. Everybody agrees on that. We are overweight as a people, and we are seriously overweight in the sense that a very large proportion of our population is significantly overweight, not just a little. And the medical profession has been working on trying to understand why that's the case and come up with a plan for what to do. Doctors, biologists, nutritionists, nurses, all of them have been working. And that's good. That's what we want. But Coke and Pepsi, they have an axe to grind in this game. They don't want this conversation to come to the following conclusion, which many in the medical profession have already reached. Namely, one of the causes of obesity is drinking too much soda pop. And that therefore one way to deal with obesity is to drink less sugared water, carbonated or not. They don't want that. So Coke has announced it is siding with one part of the debate, the ones who stress exercise, in order to be able to say, it doesn't matter what you eat or drink, it matters that you exercise. Is that because Coca-Cola is interested in our well-being and our health? That question doesn't need an answer. What Coca-Cola wants, and what the financial press has made crystal clear, it wants people to think about their weight problem not in terms of the sugar water they're drinking, but rather in terms of the exercise they're not getting. It is inappropriate for a private enterprise, profit-driven entity to be telling us what the best medical advice might be when it is so transparent of what they're doing and why they're doing it. Next item. Last Sunday on Fox, Chris Wallace asked Rand Paul, running for the Republican nomination, a question about income inequality, and Mr. Paul answered, I'm going to quote now from the relevant sentence. The thing is, income inequality is due to some people working harder than others. oh goodness, this old and inaccurate story. People are rich, you see, in the minds, apparently, of Rand Paul. They're rich because they work harder, you see. Poor people, the logic is clear, are people who don't work hard. Well, I'm an economist. We study this sort of thing. So let me help Mr. Rand Paul out, because he clearly needs it. There are two ways to make income in a capitalist society legally. So we're not going to talk about stealing it. Too bad, because a lot of people do it that way. But there are two legal ways to make money. One is by working. You provide labor to an employer who pays you a wage and a salary. Your income is the wage and the salary, and you get your income because you work. However, Mr. Paul, there's another way to earn income that doesn't require you to work at all. All you have to do is own something. Land, for example. Machines, for example. Cash, for example. Get the picture? That's called property. And if you own land and provide it to other people, the other people do the work, the farmer. But you own the land, you get a rental income. You get a payment, not because you're doing anything, Mr. Paul, but because you own something. And here comes the hot news for Senator Paul. Rich people, in general, earn their income from what they own, not from the work they do. In fact, if you're rich and own a lot of stuff, you never have to do any work at all. If you own enough acreage, your rental payments make you a rich person, whether you have a job that earns wages and salaries or not. The richest people have that luxury of being able to live off the income they get from property, whether or not they bother to work, which many of them don't. So don't tell us that wealth and poverty have to do with working harder or not. The irony is it's actually the other way around, Mr. Paul. That the more property you own, the higher your income and the less need you have to do any work at all. Only the rich who live off the income of property would be supportive of someone running around the country telling the absurd story that wealth and poverty have to do with working harder or not so hard. Shame on you, Mr. Rand Paul. I'm going to respond in the time we have now to some questions, and it's going to be on wages because we're on a roll on that topic, and candidates are saying things that are really extraordinarily uninformed. Again, I'm being as polite as I know how. What has happened to wages over the last 30 to 40 years? What's the truth? What has happened to wages in the United States? Wages are the way the majority of people in the United States earn their income. The majority have little or no property. The majority depend on selling their capacity to work and earning a wage or a salary. Those are just different names for payment for the work that you do. Okay, so what has happened to wages? In economics, we answer that question by referring to something we call real wages. What does that mean? Very simple. We adjust the money wages workers are getting for the prices they have to pay. The purpose of that is simple. We want to understand what standard of living a wage payment that you get enables you to enjoy. So, for example, if your wages double, you get twice as much next week as you got this week. What's the meaning of that? Well, if all the prices you have to pay also double, you're not one step ahead. You need to take $2 for every dollar you had before. Nice, you're getting $2 higher wages, double what you got. $1 last week, $2 this week. But everything you used to pay $1 for now costs $2. It all cancels out. So what a real wage tells you is what happened to wages when you adjust for the prices that the wage earners had to pay. So here's the reality, just so you all know. In 1974, that's roughly 40 years ago, the wages, average wages workers got in the United States, adjusted for prices in terms of what the prices are now, so we can get a real sense of it, was $23 an hour. Now, you actually got much less in dollars then, but we're adjusting. We're raising the amount of dollars to take into account the fact that in those days, you didn't get as much money, but the prices were lower. So we're trying to figure out what it means today. In 1974, $23 an hour was the average wage in the United States. What was it in 2014, 40 years later? $20.67. So let me make it clear. In 1974, the real wage, $23 an hour. In 2014, the real wage, $20.67 an hour. That's a drop of about 10%. Let me say that again. Over the 40 years, from 1974 to 2014, the real wage, what you could afford to buy for an hour of your labor, dropped 10%. So if you're feeling pinched in your economic life, there's nothing wrong with you. You're not mistaken. You didn't not save enough. None of that. Your reality is you paid less well than you were 40 years ago. During that time, workers became much more productive. They produced much more for the employer year after year than the year before. The employer got all the benefit. Their wages, in terms of what they could live off of, went down. And whatever anyone else tells you, please remember, the real wage of the American worker has been declining for those last 40 years. Yeah, it goes down a few years, it goes up a few years. But when you look at the broad 40 years, we're talking about a serious decline. That's the fundamental truth. We've come to the end of the first half of this program. I want to ask you, please, stay with us. And along the way, please remember the websites that we maintain. Completely renovated website this last week, by the way. democracyatwork.info. That's all one word, democracyatwork.info. And please visit that website. You can communicate with us. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. You can tell us what you think about the program. You can send in questions. Most important, though, please stay with us. We're going to have a very short break. Then we'll come back with some major issues that we're going to treat in the second half of today's program. Welcome back, friends, to the second half of Economic Update, a regular program brought to you by Richard D. Wolff. That's me, professor of economics, and I am enjoying immensely not only doing this program, but receiving the flood of emails that you're sending us. Please keep that up. It's full of advice that's useful, questions, comments, criticisms, and a couple of special things I want to mention today in an encouragement for you to let us hear from you. We are on 46, 47 stations around the United States today, and we're looking to be on more. If you know of a station that might be interested, especially if you know someone connected to such a station, please go to our websites and communicate that information to us. There's a person we have now working on this process who will get back to you and follow up on any initiative like that you take. Likewise, if you're interested in discussing with us a speaking appearance on my part, I move all around the United States now regularly, and I'm looking for opportunities to speak with interested organizations, community organizations, universities, labor unions, a whole raft of them. And again, we will respond very quickly if you have any ideas. I am scheduled, though, just to, for example, over the next few months, to be speaking in Tampa, Florida, Houston, Texas, Kansas City, Fresno, California, Seattle, Washington, Berkeley, California, Ames, Iowa, and a whole host of others. The websites to go to, democracyatwork.info. And let me particularly urge you to take a look at that website. It's been completely redone. The redoing of it was launched this last week, so it'll look a little different, but we have more capability than we've ever had. And of course, you can sign up for our newsletter, our free newsletter, which I urge you to do. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter by simply clicking on the icon, and you can communicate to us anything and everything that's on your mind relevant to what we try to do here. The other website, rdwolf.com. So democracyatwork.info, rdwolf.com, ways for you to participate and engage with us. I got a number of emails already that I want to draw your attention to also. Yes, I do give a public lecture the second Wednesday of every month at the historic Judson Memorial Church on Washington Square in New York City. The next one will be Wednesday, the 9th of September. The public is welcome. This would be a chance for me to meet you and for us to have a back and forth that may, I believe, be of interest to you. Okay, let's move on to some major issues. And I'm going to try to squeeze in more than I normally do because I have such a list of materials that I was hoping to get to today. One of you wrote to me recently and expressed your upset about the difficulty of getting people to understand the dangers of global warming, of a climate change that threatens large parts of the world with all kinds of problems. And in your email, you said, this is an abstract idea. You can't point to something happening immediately around you to prove it, to make it something that people immediately feel and experience. And so it's very hard to mobilize opinion to deal with this problem. And you're very distressed about it, you, the person who wrote to us. I would like to politely and respectfully disagree. I don't think it is difficult to mobilize public opinion around something that's abstract, that doesn't have a concrete example. Let me give you, sadly, an example from recent history. Back at the early years of this millennium, early after 2000, the United States political and military establishment decided that it needed to have a war in Iraq. Okay. We had just had 9/11. The American people were perfectly understandably upset about all of that. And so the argument began to be made, we have to fight a war in Iraq. And following arguments were made. They had something to do with 9/11. Indeed, they have to be punished for doing that terrible thing to us. Footnote, there was no evidence that Iraq had anything to do with it. The people who did that were mostly from Saudi Arabia. They have a different politics, a different religious commitment. And it really made no sense at all. Number two, we had to demobilize the weapons of mass destruction that Saddam Hussein had gathered and was ready to unleash on the world, including the United States. We now know that that was made up, too, that there were none. The United States looked for a year and a half, couldn't find any. That's how bad that idea was. But nonetheless, the population, the majority at least, were mobilized, terrified about a great threat, and mobilized, spent trillions of dollars since 2003 on the war in Iraq, killed huge numbers of Iraqi people, American troops, a whole generation with mental troubles coming back. We know all of that. The American people were mobilized around an abstract idea, which in fact was false. So it isn't difficult. If there were the kind of consensus by our political and military leaders, which there was, they mobilized the opinion. If there were a consensus about global warming, they'd mobilize opinion, we'd get action. We would get trillions spent and solve the problem. The reason we don't is not because it's an abstract idea. The reason is there are people who don't want such a consensus. They're fearful that if people begin to get mobilized around global warming, they will not be able to make money off of their oil and gas explorations, their oil and gas extraction, their production of all kinds of toxic chemicals or products that have toxic byproducts. They don't want that. So the reason we have trouble is that the private profit interests of powerful groups have a vested interest in preventing, dispersing, undercutting that very consensus. That's our problem, not the idea being abstract. Moving along, a number of you, quite a few over the years, literally, have asked me to talk about inequality, which I've done. But mostly I've tried to show how our system, the way capitalism works, produces and deepens inequality, unless and until there's a pushback from the mass of people, such as happened in the 1930s, that's the last time it really did. And I found it very amusing, having said this, that Thomas Piketty's book became a sensation last year because he does it in more formalized economic terms. And since then, a number of you have written to me, okay, we now understand how the system produces and deepens inequality, but tell us a little bit, talk about the consequences of inequality. In other words, why should one be upset by, opposed to, critical of economic inequality? Well, the answer is you might not like it just because you don't like to see some people rich and some people poor. But there's another reason, namely, you could see that it'll have all kinds of social effects. And if you don't like those, well, then you don't want the inequality because it contributes to those. It's perfectly reasonable. So let's talk about that. What are some of the consequences of inequality of the sort we have in modern capitalism that we might want to worry about? Well, let's start with the corruption of politics. Here's a simple theoretical argument for you to keep in mind. When you have growing inequality, when there is a small number of people getting more and more into their hands, and a middle and a mass of lower income people that keep losing, which is a fair summary of what we've had, say, in the United States over the last generation, you create by the very inequality an anxiety on the part of the rich. What's the anxiety? Very simple. We are becoming very rich. The mass of people around us are not. They're going to get jealous, envious, bitter, critical, and they may try to what? Change the situation. Well, how could they do that? Well, they could pass laws that tax the wealth of the wealthy, that tax the high income of those at the top of the pyramid. Whoa. And how does a tax get into law? It's passed by the legislature. Politicians vote on propositions about taxation. That's how we do it in the United States. So the rich people realize the only way we can protect our unequal wealth is to make sure that there aren't enough politicians to pass the laws that could undo our wealth. So we have to control politics. Now, how would rich people go about doing that? They use what they have, and what they have is wealth. To make a long story short, they buy the political system. They make the parties dependent on their money. They make the candidates dependent on their money. They flood the houses of the legislature with armies of lobbyists who reward the politicians who do what they want and punish those who don't. It is the financial corruption of politics. It makes a joke out of democracy. It means the candidate with the most money is the one who we will see on TV most of the time, who could smear his or her opponents, celebrate himself or herself, drown out everybody else because they have more money with which to do it. So one of the consequences of economic inequality is the financial corruption of your political system. And we here in the United States hardly need much in the way of illustration. Just pick up the newspaper virtually any day. Here's another consequence. Culture splits into high culture and low culture. People who are very rich want to circulate with more people who are very rich. That's the way this system works. They begin to want luxuries. They want to enjoy their money. They don't want to be in places where you can't do that. They don't want to be in places where they have to be near people who don't have that money and then worry about their anger, their resentment, their hostility. It's a system that feeds on itself. So they want their own country clubs and their own movie theaters and their own golf clubs and their own operas and their own. You get the picture. We split into a mass culture for people who don't have much money and a high culture cultivated with highly praised athletes or singers or dancers or writers. It becomes a divided culture, and the consequences there are enormous. Another consequence of capitalist inequality. The people who are rich love their children. I'm assuming that, just like everybody else. And one of the things rich people want to do for their children, which is something middle and lower income people would want to do too, but they don't have it, is to pass their wealth. Middle and lower income people can't leave anything to their children because they don't have much. Wealthy people have something. So one of the things wealthy people do is to go after inheritance tax laws, get them amended, get them removed, so they can leave their wealth, or at least most of it, to their children. That is, one of the consequences of unequal wealth is the perpetuation of that very inequality. Wealthy people want to perpetuate. And that means that the mass of people cannot start over, in a sense. You can't have the next generation start on a level playing field with everybody having the same chance. Because what you do is the wealthy pass their wealth, thereby giving their children an enormous advantage to become what they already are, which is wealthy. And it worsens the problem systematically. Here's another one. Education. Wealthy people want education. Well, as I pointed out earlier in this program, if you want the really good education, you're going to have to go to a decreasing number of schools that are still holding on to the old model, that haven't converted everything over into the adjunct approach that I described earlier. So wealthy people want to go to the best schools, which cost the most money, to get their children a leg up. And what you're creating is a class-divided education system in which money gets its kids the advantage that people without money don't get. So you worsen the problem again that way. In this country, there's yet another one. Food. It has become clear to most Americans that a large part of the food we eat is downright dangerous. It's produced by corporations who produce products that will sell. If it will sell and they put this dangerous chemical in it, they put it because it sells. Makes it taste sweet, makes it taste like pineapples, makes it taste you name it. Processed foods that are really chemical concoctions designed to get money out of your wallet so you buy those chips, that ice cream, or whatever it is. Wealthy people use their money to escape the dangers of mass-produced food. They buy organic. They go to Whole Foods or another organic market. They pay three times the price other people pay for tomatoes, but they reduce the chemicals that may kill them in the process. So we are literally seeing as a consequence the splitting of our diets, the diets for those with money and the diets for those without. A couple more just to get you the flavor. Global inequality, the grotesque difference between the standard of living, even as it's going down in Europe, say, on the one hand, and in Africa on the other, produces a flood of refugees, people leaving the countries that are on the low end of the inequality scale, trying to get to the countries at the high end, for the obvious reason that any human being, which is to produce for my family and myself a better chance at a better life than what I have here in this poverty-stricken part of the world. I'm part of a system that produces huge wealth at one pole and immense poverty at another. Are we surprised that there are refugees? I'm only surprised there aren't more. And we read every day of the catastrophe, those who die on the water or in the desert as they're trying to get from poverty to a decent standard of living. So the refugee problem, with all of its horror, is itself a product of a system that produces absurd inequality for all the reasons we've talked about in the past. But I want to go a step further and show you that this, too, worsens the problem that it reflects. When refugees leave, who leaves? Most of the time, it's relatively young people, men and women, in the prime of their lives, 20s, 30s. These are people who have been educated at the expense of the poor country from which they are leaving. They're the people who, if they applied their muscles and their brains, are the backbone of how to build an economy in those areas that they need. But they're leaving. People needed most in the country they're leaving are leaving, which will make economic development in that country harder, slower. And what happens when they arrive, say, in Europe? Well, the same would apply to Central Americans coming to the United States, for example. We have them coming and they are taken advantage of. They are herded into ghettos. Employers pay them less than they would pay Native Americans or Native Europeans. So the local people hate them because they are depressing the wage level in their minds. They don't see the system as the problem. They get angry at a victim. They don't want to be victimized, so they get angry at another victim. This creates tension and difficulty. Meanwhile, the wages in the country to which the refugees come are also pressed down. So it worsens inequality where the refugees arrive, and it worsens the basic inequality that made them be refugees in the first place. It's not a solution. It's the evasion of a solution that makes the problem worse. Finally, if I had more time, I would talk to you about how inequality has a lot to do with war, and always has. War as the final political act, when you can't solve your problems in other ways, problems that often have to do with inequality and the social consequences of inequality, well, then you go to war. And that's been a traditional relationship as well. So when we talk about the inequality generated by capitalism, it's not just that the inequality itself is an affront to notions of decency, of democracy, of community. It's also a notion that the inequality is a contributor to a host of problems which could be either solved or at least ameliorated, moderated, partly solved if we did something about the underlying inequality out of which these problems grow. In the time that we have left, let me talk a little bit about something that came up this last week that touches a topic I feel bad that I don't talk about more. The topic is advertising. It's a very important part of our economy, and some of you have said correctly that I ought to spend more time talking about. Let me get at it for today in the following way. Over the last month or so, there's been a great deal of agony among psychologists, and particularly those that are part of the American Psychological Association, the APA, which is the official mainstream organization of psychologists all across North America. They had their annual meeting, and this year it was a very tense and difficult meeting because of a report that the APA had commissioned by a lawyer from Chicago named Hoffman. And in this report, he was asked to look into the charges that members of the association, psychologists, recognized, credentialed psychologists, had participated in the American government's program of torturing people after 9/11. Mr. Hoffman, the lawyer from Chicago, wrote in his report, which is available if you go to the American Psychological Association websites, you can trace all this down. Mr. Hoffman's report indicated that indeed psychologists had done that, and that this raised the most fundamental ethical questions anyone can imagine. Let me explain briefly so we all understand. There is something called the Hippocratic Oath. That is, it comes from ancient Greece, and the idea is it's a code of ethics that everyone in the healing professions, doctors, nurses, anyone like that, including, of course, psychologists, psychiatrists, psychotherapists, and all the rest of that profession, it's a maxim, a set of propositions that everybody understands are the basics of medical or healing ethics. And the first proposition, very simple, do no harm. Do no harm. That is, everyone in the healing arts knows that whatever else you do, what debate you have, what questions you have, what parts of the process of healing you don't quite grasp yet, one rule that you always observe is do no harm. Don't make a sick person sicker. You may not be able to help him or her. You may have questions about how best to do it. But you never do something hurtful, something harmful. Do no harm. A psychologist who tortures, who explains torture, how to torture, monitors the torture, improves and corrects the torture, is doing harm. That's what torture is. It's harming a person, creating pain to get information. The American Psychological Association, to their credit, has apologized to the world for having violated the rule, do no harm, and pledges to do everything in its power, and there's a list of steps they're going to take, to prevent future psychologists from participating in something that is all about doing harm. Why am I bringing this up? Because it has an economic dimension that I don't want anyone to miss. Psychologists have been much active in the field of advertising. What does that mean? For decades now, and it's very American how all this unfolded. And indeed, I might mention a book, Stuart Ewan, E-W-E-N, Stuart Ewan, Captains of Consciousness. It's an old book, 20 years old, the best book I ever read on how the advertising business got going. But if you know something about it, here's what you know. Advertisers want to sell more of what they're producing to make more money. That's simple. Long ago, they began using psychologists because they discovered they could sell more goods if they could link the purchase of a good to some psychological weakness, anxiety, or fear you have. Do you worry about your weight? Do you worry about how you look? Do you worry about how you present yourself? Here, buy this commodity, and it will help you solve that problem. In other words, the psychologists taught capitalist enterprises how to play on people's psychological anxieties. That is cruel. That is not helpful. That does harm. When we talk about advertising next week, we will pick up on this topic. We've come to the end of our time. Thank you very much. Please join me in thanking truthout.org, that remarkable independent source of news and analysis that I urge you to check out. Please make use of our websites, rdwolf.com and democracyatwork.info, to communicate with us, to click on the icons so you can follow us with Twitter or Facebook, to send us your criticisms, to let us know what you think, to follow us in the way of a partnership. That's what we want. That's what we look forward to. And I look forward to talking with you again next week. Yeah, but yeah.